Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the studio today is David Shields, who is the Carolina Distinguished Professor of the English Language and Literature at USC. And on the line from Charleston, Kevin Mitchell, who is the Chief Instructor at the Culinary Institute of Charleston. And so, gentlemen, both of you, welcome to the Journal.
Glad to be here, Walter.
We're going to talk today about your latest book. It's entitled Taste the State, South Carolina's Signature Foods, Recipes, and Their Stories. And first of all, gentlemen, I'll start with you, David, and then bring in Kevin. How did this joint venture come about?
Well, I got contacted by the University of South Carolina Press a few years ago. And the chief of the press said, I'd like to do a book about the top 10 dishes from South Carolina. And this sounded too much like a YouTube venture for me, so I said, I'm not interested. And then he said, well, we're really interested in doing a South Carolina food book. What would it take for such a thing to come into existence? And I said, it'd have to go in depth. That is, not 10, but most of the really important signature items. And I would have to have a collaborator. Someone who is a culinary professional and someone who is conversant with African-American Gullah Geechee culinary history. And I'd been working with Kevin for years. He's a friend of mine, and we collaborated in a number of projects, and he can tell you about some of those.
All right, Kevin, it's to you. And what are some of the things you and David had been collaborating on before you got together with this book?
Well, we met back in 2013, 2014, when Charleston hosted the Carolina Gold Rice Foundation's Rice Symposium. I was asked to do a demo on chicken bog, and I met David at the symposium at this demo. And then we reconnected again in Charleston, I believe, in 2014 again. With the American Culinary Federation, they had their Southeast Regional Conference here in Charleston. And Dave and I reconnected, and he told me the story of Nat Fuller, who was one of the great black caterers from Charleston in the early to late 1800s. And he posed this idea that we would recreate a dinner that he held here in Charleston shortly after the Civil War, to celebrate the end of the Civil War, celebrate blacks and whites in the spirit of reconciliation and equality. So that was our first project together. And then we moved through later on in 2015, where we did a field pea tasting, where we revitalized the work of George Washington Carver as it relates to the field pea. And between 2016 to 2018, I left the state of South Carolina, went off to get my graduate degree at the University of Mississippi, and David and I kept in contact during that two-year span. And when upon my return to Charleston, David approached me with this idea of the two of us writing a book together.
David said, at first, it's not the top 10 foodstuffs, which is what Richard Brown from the press wanted, but it is South Carolina from asparagus to waffles.
That's right.
Not quite A to Z. And you have the recipes, but this is not a cookbook per se, although people could use the recipes, right, David?
Oh, they could. We've tended to reproduce the most historic sort of classic recipes, which are not in modern recipe format. They don't lay out the ingredients ahead of time. It's sort of like a paragraph. So you have to have some conversance with cooking technique to uncode those. But Kevin Mitchell supplied some updates of the tradition, and those are in the modern form.
Well, it just seems like having a little bit of familiarity, not anything like y'all, with older recipe, but receipt books, the ingredients sort of pop up as you do them. It just says you start off with potatoes and then the eggs come in or whatever. It's sort of cooking the way it used to be done. I asked my dear wife who can make beautiful pie crusts, and she said she was taught by her family cook who told her you can either do pie crusts or you can do biscuits. No good cook can do the same. You have to have a talent for one. And she doesn't use any recipe. She just does the way she taught, and then she just the way the dough feels, and then she knows it's ready.
You know, that's interesting. In the 19th century, the great chefs of America, the people who were operating in Delmonico's and other things, did not write down their recipes. And you were apprenticed in a kitchen by examining the chef doing things. And it wasn't until the 1880s that Charles Ronhoeffer puts out the first recipe book, which reveals what professional culinarians are doing in the kitchen. Most of the recipe books that have been produced up until this point are for household cooks or for people learning.
Now, there clearly were recipe but receipt books or cookbooks prior to the 1880s. You know, the Carolina Housewife, the Virginia Housewife.
Right.
I mean, this goes back to the 18th century.
Yeah, the 1790s. And what you'll notice is that all of those early cookbooks are designed for usually orphaned young girls who are training to be household cooks. And you'll have these prefaces about them. Now, the Southern cookbooks, the Carolina Housewife, the Kentucky Housewife, and the Virginia, Mary Randolph's book, are similarly a guide to sort of home cooks who presumed to be female, not professional culinarians. And it's household cooking, home cooking, rather than the cooking that you have in public.
Given literacy skills back in those days, they're producing these cookbooks. But I'm thinking South Carolina, those who were using the Carolina Housewife. The Carolina Housewife wasn't doing the cooking herself. She was directing somebody else how to do it.
Right. And what's interesting about that is that, you know, when we take a look at, and Kevin knows this, he wrote his MA thesis in Mississippi on this. There were situations where you would have a free African-American woman confectioner, Sally Seymour, Eliza Seymour Lee, and the various town people would sign over their enslaved cooks to Sally Seymour, and Sally Seymour would educate these cooks by apprenticing them in their kitchen. She wrote down her recipes because a number of them survive in commonplace books. So there is a literacy dimension that is going, sort of crossing through literate free African Americans to enslaved.
You early on mentioned in the book that the taste of the state, and you're talking about South Carolina, there are three cultures that come together in South Carolina cuisine. We're talking about European, which, by the way, there are about eight or different nine ethnicities involved there, West African and Native American, and frequently the Native, until actually fairly recently, Native American influence, as important as it was, has been left out. Although I can tell you from having read the inventories, among the first references to an enslaved person in the kitchen were Native American women. Kevin, I'm going to let you talk a little bit about, first of all, the West African influence in the actual foodstuffs, whether we're talking about benny seeds or guinea squash or what have you, and then we'll get into preparation a little bit later. The West African influence was considerable, was it not?
Yes. And, I mean, you mentioned a couple of ingredients. You know, benne plays a very important role in the influence of Southern food from those cooks. Of course, you have to talk about rice, specifically Carolina gold rice. You have to talk about things like okra and watermelon and so many other ingredients that were grown, cultivated, brought over by, you know, the enslaved African. And cooking those particular ingredients, not only for other enslaved people, but for their slave owners as well.
We mentioned guinea squash. We talk about eggplant. But the variety that was used in South Carolina and preferred in South Carolina wasn't that big purple thing that we see in the grocery stores today. What was it like?
Yeah, exactly. They were a little bit smaller. They were a lot, I say, you know, as far as texture, really tender. The skin probably could have been a little bit thinner than, you know, the big purple globe or whatever eggplant that plays heavily in today's times. That squash back then, of course, would have been, once again, smaller. It would have been many different varieties. It probably would have been a different color. It may not have been that deep, dark purple, once again, that we look at or think about when we talk about this guinea squash, Kevin, that people eat.
Kevin,
here
I think
today.
He's also thinking about the red Solanum ethiopicum.
Yep.
The one that looks like a tomato that got lost.
But one thing that they all had in common is they were bitter. A colleague from off moved to South Carolina, and his wife bought some eggplant, and she cooked it for dinner and didn't soak it before. Being polite as we were, my wife and I did eat one slice each, but it was it was most unpleasant.
Kevin, do you salt your eggplant slices before you process them?
I do. And that was basically, you know, a technique, of course, that I learned in culinary school. And I'll be quite honest with you, I'm not the biggest fan of eggplant. and I'm not really sure why. I think maybe for me it's a texture thing. But when I do use it here with my students or even sometimes at home, I definitely salt it to, for one, of course, it helps release a lot of the natural moisture water that's in that eggplant. And also it does kind of tame down some of the bitterness of it as well.
Yeah. And of course, the method that it was used for cooking it, even in the 19th century, was the traditional West African method of frying it.
Mm-hmm.
The Brazilians still keep their little red eggplant. They call them guilos. And their favorite bar food, sliced and cooked up with onions. So if you go to a bar in Rio during soccer season, this is what you'll be served as one of the things.
Instead of the big jar of pickled eggs?
That's right.
Or pickled pig feet. Now, a historical footnote, and David, I know that you are really engaged in helping to reintroduce heritage fruits and vegetables into South Carolina, and that is the guinea squash, this colonial vegetable, died out, and the last seeds were destroyed in a fire in Louisiana. So the ones that are grown now that look like the 18th and 19th century guinea squash really came in from Brazil.
That's right, exactly. And it was a shame of the line of red guinea squash that survived was collected from an African-American farmer in Natchez, and Seed Savers had it at this one place in Louisiana, and some drunk character burned up the seed house.
Oh, gosh.
And we lost that one. And what's important about it, you know, you can bring in the Brazilian seed, but that seed that had been handed down in Natchez is locally adapted to the Southeast. And when you plant a seed from West Africa or Europe, it undergoes transformations in the soil and different climate. The epigenetics trigger different sorts of manifestations. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason we have a lot of different varieties of collards. People who tried to save seed from European heading cabbages found that they wouldn't head in the South. They just formed flat leaves. And so the category of cabbage collards all have heading cabbages as ancestors.
Well, there's a common misperception that collards were introduced from West Africa, and that's not the case. It was a European vegetable, which very quickly became very popular with all segments of the Southern community, but especially in the African-American community. It was nutritious, and it was inexpensive.
Right. Kevin, who wrote up the thing on collards, perhaps you want to comment on it.
You know, the collards, as you said, definitely played very well in the kind of the canon of food that African-Americans eat. I mean, then and even today. And, you know, we talk about one of the first varieties of collards in the book. It's called the blue stem collard that kind of developed a little bit after the Civil War, where this green is, as you said, once again, very nutritious. And what happens is we write about collards, but we also write it in conjunction with pot liquor, right? Mm. And how the pot liquor left over from this beautiful pot of cooked greens, which would be given to enslaved people after the slavers would only eat the greens, without really them understanding that that was the most nutritious part of the green, the liquor that you actually cook those greens in. So, you know, you go through this kind of this thing where you are looking at these different types, you know, then of course, after you're looking at, you know, mustards and, you know, turnip greens and, you know, even beet greens, which all are somewhat bitter, but, you know, in the cooking, we do things to kind of take away some of that bitterness. Like for what I do when I work with mustards, for example, I will kind of blanch and shock them, you know, kind of drop them in some boiling water for about a minute or so, and then drop them in some ice water to stop the cooking process. But in that boiling water, along with salt, I do add a little bit of baking soda, and that kind of tails back that bitterness. And then I also combat that as well. I'll throw in a little bit of elderflower honey at the end to, once again, offset that bitterness.
Well, now, you didn't mention putting any salt meat in with your collards or your greens.
I do. It depends on my mood. At home, we're not necessarily using ham hock. I mean, we are using a smoked product. We use smoked turkey tails or smoked turkey necks. You know, my fiance she doesn't eat pork, so we have to find that substitute. But I don't necessarily use like salt pork. I will use bacon in that recipe with the mustard greens. You know, it's caramelized onions with this rendered bacon, the rendered bacon fat, and then for a little spice, some red pepper flake, and then just slowly toss the greens in with that just long enough so they warm through. So when I deal with greens, I'm not cooking them in a pot with water and ham hock for hours upon hours. For me, I believe it cooks out all the nutritional value in those greens. So it's onion, rendered bacon fat, lightly tossed with red pepper flake, a little salt. And then, you know, I like to also be a little daring, and I add a little bit of bourbon to my pot of greens as well.
Well, now I'm going to remember that at New Year's. Growing up on the Gulf Coast, we always had Andouille sausage in our collards, which makes it nice and hot. And at an early age, my grandfather introduced me to the pot liquor. No matter what the green, whether it was turnips or collards, he didn't really care for mustards. He always insisted that the pot liquor, he had it always. We had cornbread. And then he said, this is what you learn to drink. And I can remember that the ladies of the household didn't want pot liquor. I mean, I guess maybe when it's cooked with salt meat, it is a little bit oily, but it's good. I still love it.
Well, my grandmother grew up in, you know, I grew up in the North, so I'm from off, as you would say, but my grandmother grew up in North Carolina, and she was famous for sitting down with a bowl of pot liquor and a huge chunk of cornbread and would dip her cornbread in this pot liquor and just sit there and eat it bowls and bowls, you know, at a time. She would also do that with, she would dip her cornbread in a bowl of buttermilk as well.
All right, Kevin, you're talking about your grandmother and cornbread, and that's a nice segue into cornbread in South Carolina. And historically, David, where did that come from?
Cornbread derives from Native American foodways. They had a boiled cornmeal and water and duck fat salt preparation, a fried cornbread at numbers of people, the Lumbee, the Catawba practiced. What's interesting about the South Carolina tradition of cornbread was that originally it had only used white flint corn. The idea of having yellow cornbread was unthinkable until the 20th century.
Okay, I was going to say, I grew up mid-20th century and the cornbread was all yellow.
What happened was the National Dominion of Midwest Yellow Dent Corn won. The huge suppliers and growers of corn sent their cornmeal out to the grocery chains all across the United States. They sent the Midwest Yellow, and it supplanted the preferred white corns that were used in the South in many instances. Your first packaged cornbread mixes were using this commodity corn.
Well, or places like Anson Mills and what used to be Geechee Boy.
Marsh Hen now.
Yeah, you know, down on Edisto. Are they producing, they produce a white cornmeal, do they not?
They do. And in the case of Anson Mills, we found the original Sea Island white flint corn that it survived. Ted Chuning had some. It survives also in Florida. Glenn Roberts brought the crop back. So you can have white flint grits and white cornbread if you use their product. And a number of other mills are using other types of white dent corn, like Cox Prolific and Hickory King, which is another famous one. And there's a kind of flinty chewiness to it. You know, when you think about what differentiates Southern food from American food, there are a couple things you think of immediately. Instead of the cow, it's the pig. Instead of wheat bread, it's cornbread. And South Carolina, you can do further differentiations. Cornbread also had a rival, and that's rice bread. And rice bread was universal, at least in the Lowcountry, until the 1920s. It was on every table at every meal.
All right, well, what did rice bread look like? Was it like cornbread?
It was in loaf form, and it was a mixture of wheat and rice. It was a 4-to-1, 4 parts wheat and 1 part boiled rice.
Oh, okay, so it's actually the rice, not a rice flour. It actually included rice.
But rice flour was later on incorporated. And it's interesting, you know, rice flour doesn't become a major part of South Carolina cooking until about the Civil War era. And it has to do with mill technology, getting the rice so fine that you can make a creme de riz out of it. And that's the absolute best sort of base for a sauce that you would want. It's great batter if you want to fry fish in it and don't want to have that crunchy cornmeal. Beer and rice flour, that's the basis of tempura batter in Japan, and it was the basis for a lot of frying that went on here and still does to a certain extent.
All right, gentlemen, we need to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Kevin Mitchell and David Shields about their latest book, Taste the State, South Carolina Signature Foods, Recipes, and Their Stories. Kevin, before we identified ourselves, we were talking about cornbread. Do you make cornbread that has sugar in it?
I am definitely team sweet cornbread. And that's mainly because that's how I grew up. My grandmother always made sweet cornbread. The only time I do not eat sweet cornbread is if I'm having a bowl of chili. I will not, but she always used cornbread in her stuffing for turkey, for the holidays, and was always sweet cornbread.
There's one more corn food that, of course, that has been a key part of South Carolina recipes and meals for more than three centuries, and that is hominy, and it's many variations. And David, let's start off talking about, some people say hominy when they're really talking about grits, and some people will call grits hominy, and it's not, but they're all different.
Right. Well, originally, hominy is nixtamalized corn, and that means it was processed with lye. They used the ash of usually hickory. And Native Americans did this as a general practice in corn preparation because by some experience of many generations, they realized that consuming it made them healthier. And it was only in the late 19th, early 20th century that we realized that that corn, if you have an all-corn diet, there's something in corn that does not permit the niacin in the corn to be uptaken in the human body. And a niacin deficiency disease arose called pellagra throughout the South. But if you nixtamalize it, a chemical reaction occurs which allows the niacin in the corn to be taken up. And so the Native Americans, they didn't know it was niacin, but they realized that ash treating the corn made it healthier for them to consume. Now, settlers took this over, and they had two varieties that they made: whole corn kernels called Big Hominy and what's now called Pasole in the sort of national.
It looks like popcorn.
Yes, big kernels with the husks stripped off. And then there was a small hominy, which was milled lye-treated corn. Now, most early 19th century grits were made from nixtamalized corn. They became hominy grits. But in about the 1870s, 1880s, millers, particularly in upstate, decided that you really didn't need to ash. You just dry the corn down and grind it. And so grits that aren't hominy got out there. And I would say the majority of the grits that you have now is just dried corn that's been milled.
David, or whoever wrote the one on grits has some pretty harsh words about a lot of the glop that is served in restaurants today, and I got to find that quotation.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm not a fan of library paste when it comes to the grits. And part of it was the Insta-grits revolution. Sometimes there are revolutions that just shouldn't have been.
What's interesting, last night we were out to dinner and my fiance had a dish was called, well, fish and grits. Some fried flounder served over on top of some grits. And they were this huge glob of, you know, of course, ground cornmeal, but it was very, it was almost like it was molded into a block. And it was not of the consistency of which, you know, we really come to know, you know, a really nice pot of hot grits, what it should be. And, you know, David makes that point really well. You know, going out to dinner or going to restaurants, period, and having like shrimp and grits or something, you know, with grits, you know, we get very critical about how those grits are cooked and how they're presented.
Yes, one of the reasons why heirloom corn has come back with a vengeance is people realize that certain corn varieties are out there that have more flavor than modern agronomic corn. And if you're making your grits, whether they're instant or even stone milled with bad tasting corn, you're just doomed to failure from the start.
Well, having grown up having to, and I mean having to have grits every morning, winter or summer, anything could be served with it. Fried fish, it was usually bacon, occasionally sausage. Doves were very nice in season, but you had to have grits, and you could not put any sugar on it. It's salt and pepper and butter, nothing else.
What's interesting, what you're describing is actually the sort of attitude that lots of South Carolinians had toward rice. You could cook virtually anything in rice and make a pilau or a purlieu or a pilaf. I mean, there are all sorts of names for it. It was the Universal Donor Cooked Grain, and an incredibly broad repertoire of dishes developed as a result of that. And it's still probably the single most elaborate sector of South Carolina cooking. Well,
dinner was in the middle of the day back in the 1940s and 50s still, and rice was always on the menu. It was always there, usually with gravy.
That's interesting. Kevin, when we were going through these various pilau recipes, were there Hop and John, of course, and red rice, but what were some of the other ones that sort of hit your fancy?
Oh, yeah, there were quite a few. Well, for me, the dove purlieu, and then there's one in here that we drew the recipe for, a fish kedgeree,
yeah.
And actually, you know, I actually had to go and kind of look that up, and I went to the Anson Mills website, and they have a recipe for it, which was really, you know, really interesting to me. You know, here we have recipe for an egg purlieu, guinea squash purlieu. You know, you mentioned Hop and John, you mentioned red rice, and then of course you have Limpin' Susan, you know, which is the tomato and okra purlieu, or even okra purlieu. Or when I first moved to Charleston and did a test kitchen for Charlotte Jenkins' Gullah Cuisine cookbook, she makes a purlieu that she called Gullah Rice that had chicken and had sausage. It had so many different things. But for me, it was really reminiscent of a jambalaya. And, you know, she made it quite clear that she was not making jambalaya. It was, you know, it's a purlieu, but, you know, there's rabbit purlieu listed here. Squab, which, I mean, I love squab. But, you know, people that go through that entry specifically, and that's one of the entries where we spend at least six pages on purlieus to get people to understand, you know, the rich history that they have here, specifically in this area.
Yeah, one of the things that's really striking is that certain ones come into fashion and other ones go out. Peanut purlieu was something that was popular in the 19th century, but now it's crab rice, which is the hot dish in the restaurant world in South Carolina.
Well, I mean, Kevin's right, y'all have at least four pages of recipes, descriptions: chicken, crab, dove, duck, egg, kedgeree. Now that has to come. That sounds like British Imperial.
Yes. Well,
from Jamaica, maybe. I came through. I mean,
probably West Indian. There are certain things that happen. For instance, in the 1790s, curry powder comes in and is immediately adopted. It's one of the things from outside that gets incorporated. Like Worcestershire sauce in the 1830s and 40s, it becomes a universal ingredient in Southern stews.
Mm-hmm. Of course. It still is.
Yeah.
I mean, and people forget how it's made. It's the same family as Nook Mom from Vietnam.
Right. Tamarind, fermented fish.
Yes. Yes. The Nook Mom factory outside Da Nang was an unforgettable smelling offense.
Right. I guess South Carolina has its paper mills and.
but obviously Hop and John, which most people know. But Limping Susan, I thought that was an interesting purlieu.
Yeah, it's pretty classic. And one of the things that Kevin said reminded me, you know, this isn't jambalaya. This is, you know, Gullah purlieu. There's another Louisiana dish, gumbo, but we don't do gumbo here. We do okra soup.
Yes. But having grown up on the Gulf Coast, I do a very mean gumbo. But it's interesting. You talk about some dishes traveling outside South Carolina, and they'll talk about it's Charleston this and it's Charleston that. If you order shrimp and grits in Virginia Beach, Virginia, they will frequently say Charleston shrimp and grits.
It's interesting.
Giving it a cachet that just being in Virginia would not have.
That's sort of interesting. It's true that Lowcountry and particularly Charleston food has an inordinate dominion over people's thinking about what South Carolina food is. But one of the things we took care was that we have the upcountry dishes. We have the Midlands dishes as well.
Well, and you mentioned gumbo. There are a lot of restaurants in the Lowcountry that talk about Lowcountry gumbo. Well, anyway, we know where it all
category came, mistake
from whence it came. But if you talk about upcountry, you got to have pine bark stew.
Yeah, pine bark stew. There's a whole world of chestnut cookery that was once real central, but the blight sort of wiped it clean. And now you only get roasted chestnuts, on the holidays, and they're either Asian or European. But we're within 3 or 4 years of the American chestnut being available again. I mean, there are big forests in southwestern Virginia, parts plantings up near Seneca.
Well, they have tried to. And yes, there is a chestnut society that is trying to reintroduce. It's a modified version of the American chestnut, simply because the blight took out the chestnuts all up and down the Appalachian chain.
Yeah. And it's interesting. It isn't the culinary end of things that's driving the restoration. It's the fact that the chestnut is the fastest growing, straightest hardwood tree known. So it's the timber industry who's behind it.
Well, sometimes there's a fight over who did what, and I guess maybe the fight over who created Lady Baltimore cake is one of the silliest ones. And I'm going to let you take Owen Wister and Lady Baltimore, David.
Well, actually, Kevin wrote that entry, but it's a really interesting story. I mean, we have a society. I think it's the Women's Exchange in Charleston. And it's this society that somehow had this recipe, which was in it. What cake was it adapted from? Was it a silver cake or something? Kevin, do you remember?
Yeah. It was always called the Lady Baltimore cake. This is actually pretty interesting entry, because as I was researching it, to figure out, like, of course, who, what, when, why, and how it kind of is named from a novel written in 1906 called Lady Baltimore. It's this the story of this man who is getting married, but he has cold feet, and he goes to purchase a cake. And the woman that sells him this cake, he falls in love with this woman. And that's kind of the beauty of this specific entry. And what we try to do is give some really interesting anecdotal kind of stories to some of the entries, so people really understand where it comes from. But,
you had two rival claimants for the proprietary control of that recipe. One was well connected socially and the other was not, but it was the non-socially well connected one who was the firstest with the mostest and was out there and ruffled the sensibilities of the upper class Charleston ladies. So a kind of campaign to demean her claim to have exclusive proprietary control over the recipe was held in newspapers, and issue after issue of newspapers sort of weighed in on the question of who had the real right to make this cake.
It was originally under the name of the Silver Cake, which seems a little bit, I guess, less elaborate. As opposed to what we think of the Lady Baltimore cake today, and we see that how this cake gets adapted by Anne Byrne in her American Cake book in 2016, but it's this adapted version that comes from the 200 years of Charleston cooking by Blanche Rhett, who can lay claim to this cake, and David makes an interesting point about where it comes from and who has, you know, the exclusive rights on this cake in a broader sense. You know, we have these conversations about who has the right to claim specific recipes or specific dishes. And what we hope to do in writing something like this, and that this particular entry, is to give people a good taste of, you know, where these things come from, you know, and how some of them do have true background story and some who are just things that can just be made up kind of out of thin air.
And one of the reasons that Blanchard got into the cooking business is her husband lost his business during the Depression, and she had a tea room. That's how the Rhett family was supported, was on William Day's cooking and Blanche running the tea room.
Yeah, there was a world of tea rooms and small restaurants between the two world wars in Charleston, also in Columbia to a certain extent, that's very interesting. And a fair amount of the creation of tradition goes on there. In our entry on peach leather, for instance, we see how something which is only first introduced, you know, like in 1921, within 4 years, becomes adopted as something that is a colonial dish, and part of the mystique of the local. But one of the things that you discover is that there are definite histories of food. And certain things that are considered signatures of a place at a certain time, 100 years later, they're not the case. Mm-hmm. The rice bird, which was the favored game bird of the early 20th century, is now endangered and you can't have it.
Yeah, a bobolink.
Yeah, a bobolink.
You've got lots of other fascinating stories, but one of the things that you do mention that I think historically to me was significant, there are only three items that are in circulation today, in use today, that are grown today, that remain from the antebellum period that have not had their flavor bred out of them. Those are collards, Jerusalem artichokes, and okra.
That's right. And one of the reasons why the Carolina Gold Rice Foundation had to form was in the 1990s. This was after Alice Waters made cooking American ingredients and not French sauces, this what American food had to be about. All these Charleston chefs started, you know, going to local farmers and getting stuff, and they prepared dishes according to the old formula. And the oldest generation of diners says, hey, the flavor's wrong. So the rice that they were using, not the right rice. The grits, wrong type of corn. So the chef said, where is this stuff? And that question generated the great restoration of so many of the Southern ingredients that's taken place in the last two decades.
Well, one thing I found puzzling is the fact that ground nut cakes and candy isn't available anymore, but I just want to know why. I mean, it's not because it can't be made.
Kevin, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, groundnut cake, yeah. We know extremely, extremely popular in this area years ago. And, you know, we think the outlawing of this treat being made due to the high attraction of flies. You see in that entry the photo of the woman holding this tray of groundnut cakes and maybe other candies, and in one hand and having a fly swatter in her other hand, because of course the sugar attracted flies. And I think the outlawing of it being sold at open market could have discouraged people from making it. And you're right. I mean, it's really not a difficult thing to prepare. And David and I have had numerous conversations looking to see who's going to be inspired to bring these back. And I actually
List the ingredients so people out in the listening audience who might be tempted to create the great signature candy of South Carolina, which has disappeared, can have an idea of what they're going to have to do.
It's very simple. Peanuts, you know, if you're wanting to look at a recipe from the late 1840s, you know, in the Carolina housewife, it's peanuts. It's a little bit of brandy. It's eggs, sugar, butter, and that is it. Those are which ingredients that, of course, that we can find throughout today.
Yeah.
You want to be more historic, you want to try to get your hands on the African runner peanut to make it. Unfortunately, you know, we have someone, Nat Bradford, who has those peanuts, and I've used them recently in my class. So this is, once again, not a very hard thing to make. It, the ingredients are prevalently found. So we hope that anyone that's out there, you know, pick up this book and look at these old recipes, and let's bring this thing back.
Hey, the same thing is true of Benny seed candy, not Benny seed wafers, but Benny seed candy. I mean, they're simple to make, you know.
Benny candy, Chef B.J. Dennis has been, he and I went down to Trinidad a number of years ago, and we saw some of those old traditional candies still being made, a Benny roll, and monkey meat, the molasses and coconut candy that was sold here in South Carolina is still being sold in little balls on the streets of the towns in Trinidad.
Fellas, the most interesting vegetable in the whole group that I had never heard of was tanya root.
Yeah. If you were a new resident in the low country, your neighbors would bring a bag of these over to greet you. They're the corm of the elephant ear plant.
But now, wait a minute. Aren't they poisonous? As a kid, because in Mobile, elephant ears grew to giant size, and you break them, you know, the stem and the sap, it'll burn.
Yeah, it's alkaloid. But, you know, when you think about roots consumed throughout the West Indies, the taro root has the same sort of alkaloid poisons. The West African yam is poisonous. But people have learned to process them just like they did this root. It was baked, boiled.
What does it taste like?
It tastes, if you've ever cooked Jerusalem artichokes and mashed them, it tastes sort of like that. A little blander than a potato. It has a sort of more glossy kind of quality to it. It's usually eaten for breakfast, and it's sometimes called edos or provision plant in the West Indies. And one of the things that you have to think about is, you know, we think we got a lot of root vegetables when we have sweet potatoes, carrots, and beets, and turnips. But if you go to a market in the West Indies today, you will find at least eight other different edible roots there, including tanya, including the West African yam called the kush, the dasheen, and the taro. And you can cook them all, and they're very tasty, and they have a whole food ways, which we had at one time.
All right, gentlemen, I'm very distressed, but Alfred is giving me the wind-up sign. And so I'm going to go to you first, Kevin. Any last words you'd like to leave for our listeners before we sign off?
Yes. What, for me personally, what I hope people get from picking up this book, that there's three things. We write about things that we know have been for years synonymous with the state of South Carolina. Second, the things that have seemed to disappear off the South Carolina food map. So like David mentioned, you know, rice birds, and we talked about the groundnut cake, so on and so forth. And then the third is that they're going to be surprised with some of the things that we write about. And even for myself, getting into the book, writing the book with David, researching, some of the things that we write about were a surprise for me. So, you know, when you open the book and you go right to asparagus, I think most people are not going to attribute South Carolina with asparagus or even oranges. So those three things. And then we also hope that, you know, it inspires some people, for me as the chef, to get into the kitchen and try some of these really great recipes that we put in the book. And then also that it entertains you with some of these anecdotal stories, specifically when we talk about the Lady Baltimore cake.
All right, David?
One of the things, too, that we should say is that there are a number of pan-Southern dishes like fried chicken and pecan pie, and we don't include things which are just generically Southern, and we don't include things which another state has a greater claim to, like pimento cheese.
Oh, see, supposedly the best pimento burger in the world used to be right here. John T. Edge said so.
Yes, down at the Dairy Bar.
At the Dairy Bar.
Yeah. But that has to be in the taste of the state, Georgia, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, as to what belongs, what, remember, we produce more peaches in Edgefield County than they do in the entire state of Georgia. So
that's why we have a peach entry.
All right. Kevin Mitchell and David Shields, gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for being with us today on the Journal and talking about your book, Taste the State, South Carolina's Signature Foods, Recipes, and Their Stories. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. Taste the State, South Carolina's Signature Foods, Recipes, and Their Stories, is truly a fascinating book. It's a look not only at the history of South Carolina's cuisine over the centuries, but also the origins of the food we eat and how it is prepared. Our foodways today reflect the multicultural nature of South Carolina history over more than 350 years. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.